Hello, everyone. Welcome to our The Week That Was in Europe podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher. I'm the head of European Macro Research at Natixis. And with me, as usual, is Klaus Adam, professor of economics at the University of Mannheim.
Hello also from my side. So today we would like to discuss about an important new trend in monetary economics that has emerged over the past 5 years, and that is the development of monetary models that allow for a serious quantitative analysis of monetary policy making and that take into account the effects of household heterogeneity. And we're very proud to have with us today Ben Moll from the London School of Economics. Ben is one of the, say, founding fathers, if one can say that, at this very young age, of these new heterogeneous agent models in monetary economics. And we are eager to hear from him about the new insights economists have gained over the last years about from this model class. And let me say, Ben Moll is also an author of the famous What If study that sought to quantify the aggregate effects of a sudden stop in Russian gas deliveries for Germany. And you may know him from that part of his research, which was very applied. But today we want to talk about his monetary research. So welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Great. Thanks a lot for having me. Great pleasure to be here, Dirk and Klaus, and I look forward to the conversation.
Right. So let's start right away with your famous 2018 paper that kickstarted a whole new literature in monetary economics, which studied the interaction of monetary policy with household heterogeneity. So the paper was published 5 years ago, 2018, in the American Economic Review. And it was written together with Greg Kaplan from the University of Chicago and Gianluca Violante from Princeton University. And the paper is titled Monetary Policy According to Hank, which perhaps for the non-initiated sounds a little obscure. So Hank, H-A-N-K, is an acronym and it stands for Heterogeneous Agent New Keynesian. So this new model class you created merged existing heterogeneous agent models, HA models, with so-called NK models, new Keynesian models, and hence the name Hank. So the heterogeneous agent models that were around prior to this innovation could either analyze distributional issues but not study monetary policy, or they could study monetary policy but really without a fully fledged quantitative component on the heterogeneity side. So why at the time did you embark on this research program? What motivated you?
Thanks a lot. Great question. So I think what motivated us was unhappiness or dissatisfaction with the state of the, you know, workhorse models for assessing monetary policy. So exactly these new Keynesian models, so the NK part of our work. In particular, the consumption behavior in those models, we thought was sort of based on a theory or an understanding of consumption that was or is somewhat outdated. In particular, the at the core of a lot of these models is the permanent income hypothesis of Milton Friedman back in the 60s, I guess, the more modern word that's often used to describe these kind of models is the Euler equation, which is one of the main equations in these standard New Keynesian models. And essentially the way these models work is when the central bank cuts interest rates, say, then households respond very strongly to that in terms of increasing their consumption. And the key mechanism for this is something called intertemporal substitution. So essentially interest rates are lower, so it's a good time to borrow, it's a bad time to save, and therefore people spend more. But the issue with this is that we know from a bunch of studies that that's not necessarily how households behave. And there's something that's perhaps even more contrary to these to the behavior in these models, which is the other thing that these models say that households do is they don't respond very strongly to how much income they have in their pockets. So in these models, households respond very strongly to interest rate changes, and they don't respond very strongly to how much income they have. And if you just think about that from introspection, Maybe that sounds wrong, and indeed, sort of empirical evidence over the last maybe 30 years has found that people don't respond to interest rate changes that much, unless maybe people have a mortgage or something like that. And on the flip side, people respond to income changes very strongly. Something that in economics we call high marginal propensities to consume. So if I give you a euro, you're gonna tend to eat maybe 30 or 40 cents of that euro on average. Whereas in these models, it would say that you'd only eat maybe 5 cents of that euro. So we basically just sort of saw this maybe intellectual arbitrage opportunity where we thought, okay, hey, we know models of consumption behavior that get sort of the empirical consumption behavior in the data of people right. And then we kind of just took those models of consumption behavior. So those are these heterogeneous Asian models you referred to, and then sort of merged those into the new Keynesian models.
So what are then the main new insights that these Hank models have generated when it comes to understanding the effects of monetary policy? You already alluded to the fact that the interest rate sensitivity, the old models, NK models, assumed you don't find it in the data. What's the progress on that front now with the Hank models?
Yeah, exactly. So we actually wrote a piece for the IMF Finance and Development magazine recently, where we sort of tried to summarize four of the main lessons that we see coming from this literature. So I would encourage listeners who are interested in a bit more background to look at that. But essentially, I would summarize the main findings as follows. So the first main lesson that comes out of this is about what we call direct versus indirect effects. And it's essentially about how monetary policy works sort of under the hood. So what's the transmission mechanism of monetary policy? And the key message is essentially, if you take seriously how people actually behave in terms of their consumption behavior, it just paints a different picture of how the transmission actually works. So in these traditional models, again, the way it works is all through this intertemporal substitution, whereby when interest rates fall, people just increase their consumption directly in response to that falling interest rate. That's what we would call a direct effect. And then in these existing models, these new Keynesian models, there are also some indirect effects. And the way it works is, when people increase their consumption in response to falling interest rates, they spend more. That increases aggregate demand in the economy. That means, firms have to produce more to meet that demand. And then they hire more workers, increase labor incomes, that puts more people, put more money in people's pockets, and they increase their consumption in response to that. Sort of a Keynesian multiplier story for those maybe who are familiar with that. But then the thing in the traditional models, so these new Keynesian models, is that multiplier is essentially tiny. So you get, it's all about the direct effects, and very little is about these indirect effects. Okay. When you write down these models with more realistic consumption behavior, these heterogeneous Asian new Keynesian models or Hank models, then it completely flips. So it becomes much more about these indirect effects, where people don't react directly to the interest rate cut, or some of them do, but only a small fraction of the population. And most people don't respond to this interest rate cut. But then what people do respond to is these indirect effects, where in equilibrium, essentially, household incomes go up, and then people have more money in their pockets and they spend out of that. Exactly in line with sort of what I told you about consumption behavior before.
So that means, if I just to clarify, you find then a bigger effect, or is it just you redistribute the direct and indirect effect? Monetary policy is found equally potent or not so potent, or is it overall a bigger impact then?
No, it can go either way. It's sort of ambiguous. In some clean benchmark results, essentially, in terms of the total effect, it will be the same. It's just that the fraction working through indirect effects is larger. But then the key thing that sort of makes it interesting is that it will then depend on all sorts of things, all sorts of features in the economy that in the new Keynesian models, these traditional models, wouldn't matter at all for the total size of the consumption response. So just to give you an example, what matters in a heterogeneous Asian new Keynesian model for how much monetary for how much consumption responds to monetary policy is how much investment responds to monetary policy. So and the reason is because if investment responds a lot, that means again, because investment is a component of aggregate demand, that means aggregate demand goes up a lot, that means there's more money in people's pockets, and that gives you a larger amplification. In a standard model, it doesn't matter for consumption how much investment responds. Another example is it matters a lot what fiscal policy does in response to monetary policy, or what we call sometimes fiscal footprints. So fiscal footprints of monetary policy matters. In standard models, this doesn't matter due to some feature of these models that's called Ricardian equivalence, which is that the timing of what the government does in terms of taxes doesn't matter so much, which again comes back to this idea that people are these sort of permanent income hypothesis consumers, where they are very forward-looking and not financially constrained. Instead, in these Hank models, people are financially constrained, and then it matters how fiscal policy responds to monetary policy. And so that's exactly another lesson that comes out of these Hank models that we emphasize in that IMF magazine piece that I emphasized.
Right. So, but in terms of the multiplier, if I may just ask, so this happens all very simultaneously, right? So some people expand spending, and as a result, income of other people go up, and they can again spend. So how do you see this play out? I mean, it all happens, very quickly in terms of the multiplier playing out. Is that really a relevant assumption, or could it sort of play out, in various rounds of spending over time? And would that make a big difference for the findings?
Right. So yeah, in the model, the way you write them down, you're indeed right that this all happens sort of simultaneously. But still, the way to understand the transmission mechanism is through these sort of second round, third round, fourth round, and so on effects. There are actually some interesting. There's an interesting empirical paper from Norway where they look at the transmission of monetary policy. It's called the transmission of monetary policy under the microscope, using some very good data. And they actually exactly find that in the real world, these indirect effects sort of happen with a lag, which is something that's not currently in these models yet, but it should be probably. So that's an interesting direction for future research. And then if you take that into account, then I guess it would matter a lot. Whether an effect is a direct effect or an indirect effect. And so if you ask me how it works in the real world, I exactly think that these indirect effects probably happen with a bit of a lag. And so then it would actually also matter for what we discussed earlier, which is sort of the impact effect of monetary policy would be smaller in these models, right? Because these indirect effects take some time to kick in.
Right. So this, as we learned, the Hank models are very rich in terms of allowing us, for richer understanding of how monetary policy transmits differently to households and how this different transmission has, in fact, different aggregate consequences. Now, they also put these models, the distributional consequences of monetary policy, into the spotlight, which hasn't been the focus for much of monetary history so much. Now, if we look, at the current period, we are not in a scenario where central banks are cutting interest rates. We're in a scenario where central banks are strongly increasing interest rates. The ECB has a record fast increase in nominal rates over the past year, and so does the Federal Reserve. So in terms of these strong surprises of interest rate rises, I mean, nothing of this has perhaps been anticipated a year or a year and a half ago. So who is losing relatively more from these increases according to these models?
Right. it's again useful, I think, to think through various some different direct effects and various indirect effects. And I think in terms of the direct effects, so just interest rates get jacked up a lot by the central bank, it's kind of pretty intuitive. So essentially, higher interest rates or quickly increasing interest rates are essentially bad for people with lots of debt. So in particular, if you have a mortgage and say you have to refinance your mortgage if it's not a fixed rate mortgage, then that's going to be a problem for you. So I'm here in the UK. I was just reading the newspaper this morning. And there seemed to be a bit of a turmoil in the mortgage markets now because essentially all the banks are kind of pulling these offers they had made to people for refinancing their mortgage. And now there's a bunch of people who are going to have to refinance their mortgage, and they're going to have to pay these really high interest rates. So that's obviously just an issue for these people who lose, because now they have to just, you know, take a larger fraction of their income towards their mortgage payment. On the flip side, obviously, if you have a lot of savings in some securities where the cash flow of these securities is linked to interest rates, say you just have a lot of savings in a saving account in a bank, and the bank passes through the higher interest rates to you, that's obviously nice for you if interest rates are higher. So it has this very intuitive distributional effects in terms of the direct effects. But then it becomes sort of more subtle with a bunch of indirect effects. So obviously, one of the reasons why the central bank is raising interest rates is in order to bring down inflation. And I guess starting to look like maybe that's having some effects. So the inflation maybe is going to fall. So that's then going to matter. It's going to matter, are the assets you're holding, are they indexed to inflation or not? Are they sort of nominal assets or not? So if you have a bunch of nominal debt, then high inflation is good for you because your debt sort of gets inflated away. And now if inflation is falling a lot, that's, I guess, less good for you. Similarly, if you have real assets, I guess, then I guess inflation works differently for you there. Then turning to these indirect effects, I guess, there's also, it matters a lot sort of what kind of income you have. In particular, is your income very sensitive to monetary policy or not? So maybe you're in a sector of the economy that's quite cyclical, that responds quite strongly to fluctuations in aggregate incomes. If you work in such a sector, and if the central bank jacks up interest rates and the economy sort of slows down in terms of the aggregate, so maybe there's a bit of a recession, that's going to be bad for you because your income is going to fall a lot. In contrast, if you're in a relatively safe or less cyclical sector, then maybe it's not so much of a problem for you if interest rates increase a lot. So I think that the summary of it all is it's pretty subtle. You cannot say, you know, the poor people lose or the rich people win or vice versa. And it's just, you know, the world is complicated, I guess. And what these models are also just saying, you know, look, the world is complicated, and it just really depends exactly what kind of assets do people hold, and so on and so forth.
I always find it a good starting point to acknowledge the world is complicated.
Yes.
Distributional issues are, if I understood it correctly, at the heart, at the core of these models, at least, are a very important element. And now that these models seem to be getting a bit more popular also among central bank policymaker circles, do you see a risk, or maybe it's not a risk at all, that distributional issues become quite important for central banks also in setting their monetary policy now that they have models who tell them a bit more explicitly how things on that front develop, that they focus a lot more on that, which in the past has always been, if you will, the focus for fiscal policy or for governments, if you will, and not for central banks.
Right. So let me give a bunch of different answers to this. So the first one I think is actually interesting, which is I think many people don't know this, but for example, the European Central Bank actually does have some distributional considerations in its objective, so in its official mandate. So, you know, everyone knows that the European Central Bank, its main mandate is price stability. But if you actually read a bit in the fine print, it also has some secondary objectives. And in particular, what it states in the treaty is something about social progress and social inclusion. And the way it's, you know, written down, it's very clear that the mandate is basically what economists would call a lexicographic mandate. So essentially, there's a primary objective or primary mandate, which is price stability. But then there's a secondary objective, which is a bunch of other stuff, which in particular includes these sort of distributional objectives. So, you know, just to, you know, set the stage for the discussion or before I want to say next, even, you know, existing central bank mandates, they do say, you know, they should care about distributional considerations to a certain extent. And again, so the way it's written is, if you have two policies that have the same effect on price stability and one is sort of better in some sense for social inclusion or distributional questions, then you should do the latter one. The second thing that I want to say is, at the same time, I think one thing that comes out of this literature very clearly, and we've been certainly saying this a lot, is that monetary policy is actually a pretty bad tool for redistribution. And the reason is just it's a very blunt tool. You just have this one policy instrument, which is the interest rate. Maybe okay, if you think about unconventional policies, you have a bit more. But certainly, it's very hard to target monetary policy to redistribute in a sort of precise and fine-grained way. In contrast, fiscal policy, you can obviously target much more precisely. So I think most people working in this literature, and certainly me and my co-authors, would agree that if you really want to do redistribution, you should probably do that with fiscal policy. At the same time, monetary policy does obviously have distributional effects, like we've said, and I think, you know, the central bank needs to be clear that whatever it does, any monetary policy has distributional effects, and then we need a framework to understand how these work. And so I guess that's kind of the balance. So you probably don't want to use the monetary policy for distribution, but you need to understand what the distribution effects are. And then in particular, some central banks like the European Central Bank have actually this sort of secondary mandate where they're even supposed to care about distribution to a certain extent. And so then you just need those models to think about that.
Right.
So yeah, I wouldn't see it as a risk. So I think there's certainly a risk, maybe let's say like this, there's certainly a risk that you can take it too far with caring about distribution. I don't think it's happened so far, and I think if anything, it's sort of so far been a good development that the central banks think about this a bit more explicitly.
Right. So let's leave a little bit now aside the distributional aspects, and let's more focus on the aggregate implications of policy decisions. We have alluded to earlier in the podcast on this already that there are quite strong interactions according to these models between monetary policy decisions on one side and fiscal configurations, alternative fiscal policies that could be pursued. For instance, these models would predict that different amounts of social insurance would have potentially a quite strong effect on how monetary policy transmits to the aggregate economy, not in terms of the distributional, just for the aggregate inflation output consumption responses in these models. So what are the main new lessons about these sort of monetary fiscal interactions that come out of this new model class?
Right. So I've already briefly alluded to this earlier when we talked about sort of the main new insights that come out of this. So yeah, one main implication of these models is again that what matters is these what we call fiscal footprints. So here's how this works. So essentially, when the central bank raises interest rates, that means that governments have to pay higher interest on their debt, right? So the treasury is going to have to pay interest rates are going to rise a bunch of different asset classes. One of them is going to be government bonds, and so they're going to have to pay more interest. That's bad for the government. That money has to come from somewhere. Essentially, there's three ways the government can generate that money or make up for that lost income, right? It's sort of a negative windfall income change for the government. And the first thing the government can do is it can increase taxes today. Second thing it can do is it can decrease government spending today. And the third thing it can do is can do one of those two things sometime in the future, right? So it can, now just let government debt increase, and then at some point later in the future, increase taxes or cut spending. In traditional models, again, these traditional New Keynesian models, it essentially doesn't matter very much which of these two options the government or which of these options the government chooses, in particular, whether it increases taxes now or whether it increases taxes later. That's this finding I alluded to earlier that's called Ricardian equivalence, or this feature of these models, that it essentially doesn't matter so much how you exactly finance changes in your spending. In these models that we have, these Hank models, it instead matters a great deal. And the reason is that people in these models are, like in the real world, we would argue, are, some of them are financially constrained and are not these very forward-looking people. Instead, some of them are sort of live hand-to-mouth and just consume whatever income they have. And as a result, what happens is if the government increases taxes now, and in particular, if it were to increase maybe taxes on poor people or people who are financially constrained, that would decrease consumption today. And that would have these sort of negative feedback effects that we talked about. Whereas instead, if you finance these higher interest rates payment that you now have because of higher interest rates through taxes in the future, that would have different effects. In this case, would have larger increases in aggregate consumption than if you do it today.
So would it be a fair summary to say that the fiscal effects on inflation are stronger than in the older class of models? I mean, the decision to spend or tax now has a stronger aggregate demand effect, and therefore, according to some Phillips curve, a stronger inflation effect.
Yes, I think that's right. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, let's finish with a final, more practical question, i.e. relating to the current rise in inflation we've seen, and which obviously has occupied central banks. And I think it's fair to say that most people misread the beginning, what's happening on that inflation front for whatever reason. But do you think if one would have looked very closely at these Hank models, then we would have understood earlier and better what's driving inflation? Would it have been helpful in real time, so to speak?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not so sure. I mean, it's certainly not true that there were a bunch of people working with Hank models who all warned about rising inflation, and we were like the only ones who saw this coming. So I certainly wouldn't want to claim that. At the same time, I mean, there is something I think where these models could have potentially been helpful, which is that, I mean, I think there's some agreement now in retrospect that some of this rising inflation was partly due to large stimulus spending during COVID, right, where the government just partly to provide social insurance, you know, pumped a lot of money into the economy. So certainly in the United States, I think that there are these huge spending programs, right, where then sometimes you know, unemployment replacement rates were basically more than 100%. So, you know, you got more money from the government than you used to make before COVID. And there's this idea that you played a role in inflation because it sort of propped up spending a lot, and therefore aggregate demand. And so that is exactly the type of finding that would come, that comes out of the Hank model, right? Because people have large margin propensity to consume. And so therefore, if you pump a lot of money into the economy, people spend a lot of that money, and that's going to give you rising inflation. So yeah, just maybe if you think more in terms of these models where people have high MPCs, and aggregate demand matters a lot, that would have led you to predict that a bit more. But then, of course, a lot of the increase in inflation was, I think due to rising energy prices, which were in turn due to you know, the war in Ukraine. It's not true that Hank models would have helped you predict the war in Ukraine, right? So that's obviously totally separate.
Right. So now your work has been actually very influential. Now let's look a little bit ahead. So where do you see this whole research program going? I mean, do you plan to contribute yourself on this in the future, or have you already moved on to other things?
No, absolutely. I definitely plan on continuing to work on this. I think there's still lots to be done. I think one big interesting hole to fill in this literature that I think maybe even so in particular, if there's sort of students maybe listening who are interested in this literature, that could be interesting, is the role of asset prices in the monetary transmission process. So I think, you know, if you look at the data and also just from introspection or talking to policymakers, we think that a fair chunk of the monetary transmission mechanism works through asset prices, right? So the central bank cuts interest rates, stock prices go up, maybe house prices go up with a lag, or now when they're tightening, the opposite is happening. And that affects aggregate consumption. That is something that's not currently in most of these models, but it really should be. And, you know, those models in a sense are very natural models to think about that, because if you think about how this works, I guess it's going to matter a lot what kind of portfolios people hold, at what points in the wealth distribution does, you know, who hold what assets. So do people hold stocks? Do people hold housing? Is it really rich people and so on? So I think that's an important topic to pursue. Another thing that I've also already alluded to earlier, I think, is this interesting thing about direct and indirect effects, and the indirect effects empirically happening with a lag. Again, I really recommend that there's this interesting paper, Monetary Transmission Under the Microscope, with this Norwegian data, and they find that these indirect effects, so these aggregate demand or multiplier effects, they work with a lag. And I think if we could somehow put that into our models, that would seem like an important thing to do as well.
Okay, let me try a summary of a not so easy topic. Why Hank models? Well, why the heterogeneous add-on to new Keynesian models? And it was an unhappiness with the consumption behavior, it seems, from these old models, which was outdated in your view. Permanent income hypothesis and all that, the empirical support for that and the Euler equation is low. So it seemed time was ripe for adding something to that, and that's what these models do, better understand the consumption behavior. And therefore, the main insight coming from that, from these models for monetary policy is indeed that the transmission mechanism is viewed differently in a sense that the direct impact or the interest rate sensitivity of consumption is not the main, or is certainly still one focus, but there are the indirect effects, the multiplier effects, which become more important, though, as you said, empirically with a lag. Who loses? So this now to the distributional part from higher rates in the current circumstances, if viewed through the lens of these models, while there are these obvious effects, people with leverage suffer, if you will, but also indirect effects that these models are able to show, and real and nominal assets is one aspect here that needs to be taken into account. Should central banks take those distribution effects more into account, or is the risk they do too much of it? And you said right away, well, actually, if you look at the ECB's mandate, you see it does include things like social progress. So looking or taking into account distribution effects is not per se a problem. And you think actually that currently and also in the past, the risk that they overdo it on that front is rather small. Fiscal monetary interaction. So the fiscal footprint matters a lot, and more specifically, what matters is how governments fund themselves via taxing today or through debt. All that matters in these models, unlike in the older version. Would Hank models have helped to understand the inflation surge a bit better? You think that's true to the extent that the fiscal transfers coming from governments in the US, but also in Europe, that's, if you will, a strong suit of these models, helping better understand how that works. And then finally, future research, the role of assets in the transmission mechanism is looks interesting to you, as well as the lagged indirect effects, which are a main feature of these models. I know that's a quick and dirty summary, but still a fair one.
Absolutely. Great summary. Yeah. And I think a lot of it, I've said it before already, can be summarized with, it's complicated. I really think so. I think there's a risk in economic modeling sometimes to just oversimplify a bit. It's a fine balance, obviously, on the one hand, modeling is all about simplifying, some things I think you just cannot simplify too much. And if you simplify too much, and I think that's what happened with these older models, you lose a lot of the actual richness of how things work in the real world. And then sometimes these can matter a lot for policy.
Yeah, I can only then hope as a practitioner that these models become accessible enough that we can use them then in our work, so we can produce forecasts without having to think too much about all these difficult side effects.
Yes. Yeah, we're working on it.
Good. Thank you very much, Ben, for your time today. It was very interesting, and I'm sure our listeners will have learned a lot.